It's Central Time. I'm Rob Fairhead. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, two meals at once. A cookbook author tells us how to turn one round of cooking into two unique meals. First, a data analysis from the Center for Public Integrity shows that Wisconsin was fourth in the nation for referring students to the police during the 2017 to 2018 school year. Wisconsin referred 9 students out of every 1,000 students in the state to the police, almost twice the national rate. Native American students were disproportionately affected by the pattern. Wisconsin was more likely than any other state to refer Native students to the police. Black and disabled students were also reported at higher than average rates. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a teacher, a school administrator, a parent, a student yourself? What are your thoughts on the use of law enforcement in schools? Why do you think this happens? When is it appropriate? When is it not? Do you hope that there are alternatives? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Angelica Usery is a reporter for Madison 365. She's co-author of a piece from Wisconsin Watch looking at police and schools in the state. Angelica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I gave some of the basic findings from this report that you worked on. Can you tell us more about what you found when it comes to how often Wisconsin districts go to the police when they have trouble with students?
Yeah, it's pretty absurd how relevant it is, how often it happens. And it happens in over half of Wisconsin schools. I think there are like 444 schools in the whole state, and 273 of them have issues with calling the police on students. And like you pretty much said, like Black students, Indigenous students, especially students with disabilities and mental health issues, are referred to way at higher rates than white students and any other students. And it's out of hand.
What did you find when you talked to school districts about what they might be trying to change, if anything, when it comes to reporting students to the police?
Yeah, that was another issue we had doing this article. There weren't a lot of school districts that responded to us. A lot of them ignored us. One school district responded to my editor and said that they were aware of the issue of policing in schools, but they didn't have a statement to say back. I spoke with Sabian Castro, the vice president of the Madison Metropolitan School District, and he talked about his experiences in schools as a Black man with disabilities, seeing his friends have situations with SROs, himself having instances with SROs and being misunderstood. So I can speak for Madison. I know that they just ended their contract with the Madison Police Department, but unfortunately, other schools in Wisconsin, other school districts weren't really responsive. And I think that's saying something.
You mentioned SRO, school resource officers. These are officers stationed in schools. And there's a big movement toward this after some of the more prominent school shootings in years past, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So SROs and actual police officers in the schools too.
Now, Native American students, you mentioned Wisconsin has the highest rate of police referrals for Native American students in the country. And in general, they have higher rates around the country. What kind of things did you and your colleagues hear when it came to why that might be?
It's unfortunate. You know, we didn't really get a response back from people. I know that Indigenous students in Wisconsin were referred twice the number that they took up in the schools. And it was just really unacceptable. We didn't really get any conversation back from school districts. I apologize. It's just unfortunate people weren't willing to talk to us about this because some students aren't safe in schools. And that is counterproductive to what the goal of SROs and police in schools are supposed to do. So, yeah.
When it comes to the data, is it pretty reliable? At least at one point in the report, you all mentioned that, one school might include in their data, yeah, we just talked to a juvenile justice counselor and include that as a referral, whereas another school district might only be, we called a police officer in this situation and they arrested the student. It seems like some of the data may not be that solid.
Oh, no, I think the data is pretty solid. The Center for Public Integrity got it from the, what is it called? The U.S. Department of Education. Like they got it from that school, the school year 2017, 2018. So like the last normal school year. I think the data stands. They've put in a lot of work. I know I put in a lot of work analyzing this data. The Wisconsin Watch put in a lot of work. And the numbers don't lie. It says what it says. So it's solid.
What are you watching for going forward on this story?
I'm just hoping to hear back from some school districts throughout the state and throughout the nation about what they're going to do to keep Black students, Indigenous students, students with disabilities safe in their schools. I think I understand the intent with SROs and police in schools is to ensure student safety. But when those people come into schools and have biases and have discrimination against certain people and are just sometimes racist, it doesn't end well for all students. And I talked to my editor and he said that some students don't even know that they're getting like reprimanded when they after they get in trouble. They just get the mandate in the mail that they've faced like criminal charges, and that's how they found out that they got in trouble in this way. And it's not necessary. I think there are healthier ways to deal with students that don't put them in the hands of police. And I'm just hoping that, you know, schools in Wisconsin draw awareness to this issue and involve the school community and involve the student voices to make sure that everyone feels safe in their schools.
Angelica, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Angelica Ussery is a reporter for Madison 365. She's co-author of a Wisconsin Watch piece on law enforcement in schools. According to national data, Wisconsin reports students to law enforcement at about twice the national rate. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts on these issues. And I want to bring in now Campbell Scribner, assistant professor of education at the University of Maryland, co-author of the book Spare the Rod, Punishment and the Moral Community of Schools. Campbell, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, you just heard the rates of police referrals in Wisconsin schools. That's just part of the spectrum of punishment you look at in your book. But when you hear numbers like this, the rates of police referrals, what do you think about why schools are turning to calling the police?
I'm a historian, so I'm going to give you the long-term answer, but I think it's part of a general process toward more bureaucratic and more formalist approaches to schools, which means more rules-based and more rigid approaches to disciplining and punishing kids. It used to be back in the days of the one-room schoolhouse in Wisconsin where you would have one teacher and they could kind of do whatever they wanted, right? You would beat the kids, you would suspend the kid, it was up to you. With the rise of bigger centralized school districts, there start to be stricter rules, right? And so when most of us went to school, it suddenly became possible that you'd be sent down to the principal's office, for instance, and there would be sort of progressively harsher punishments. Starting in the 1950s, schools start to rely out on either security guards or outside police officers. And teachers basically see it as a way of narrowing their own responsibilities and maybe their own liability. And turning punishment over either to the principal or to outside agencies. And so that's the beginning. It picks up in the 60s and 70s, but that's the beginning of punishment being less of the teacher's prerogative and more of outside agencies.
How big a turning point was the rash of school shootings, starting maybe with the Columbine shootings in Colorado years ago and one since then? Did that lead to a rise in the presence of police officers in more and more schools and the willingness to let them handle discipline?
It did. I think it really punctuated a longer-term trend. In the 1990s, as you know, there was sort of the tough-on-crime movement, especially among centrist Democrats. But even going all the way back to the LBJ era and the Great Society of the 1960s, in the wake of urban riots, you have the Omnibus Crime Bill and other big federal spending programs giving millions of dollars to local police departments, but also giving millions of dollars to school districts to hire local police departments and security guards. And so really it was a 50-year process, but it started with the influx of federal funds. And as you point out, Columbine, I think, really draws much more attention to it. And you start to see school resource officers appearing in suburban districts, whereas earlier they had been largely assigned in urban schools.
Now, a big part of that report we just heard about from Wisconsin Watch is a large proportion of the students referred to police are Native American, Black, students with disabilities. Does that fit trends of punishment you've seen in schools over the years?
Yes, it absolutely does. As I hinted, the two big drivers of police in schools, one was the sort of moral panic and juvenile delinquency panic of the 1950s and 60s. But a big part of that panic also came from racial desegregation in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education. And it's not a coincidence that you see a huge rise both in suspensions, but also in police presence in schools as you start to get racial desegregation. And almost from the beginning, it's almost entirely targeted at African-American students, Latino students, and Native students.
We're talking to Cabell Scribner, assistant professor of education at the University of Maryland and co-author of Spare the Rod, Punishment and the Moral Community of Schools. We are looking at the use of police referrals in particular and other forms of punishment and discipline in schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you see this being used in your local school district, whether you are a parent, a student, a teacher, administrator, concerned community member? Do you think there are times when it is appropriate to have that police officer stationed in the school or for the school to call the police officers? When is that the right move? When would you like to see alternatives? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about the involvement of law enforcement in schools and the use of harsh discipline measures, things like corporal punishment or solitary confinement. Across the U.S., these methods of discipline affect students of color and students with disabilities more than their peers. Cabell Scribner is an assistant professor of education at the University of Maryland and the co-author of the book Spare the Rod, Punishment and the Moral Community of Schools. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have the thoughts on the use of police referrals in school districts? Do you think there are better ways to handle problems at school? Do you have concerns about safety? Do you have a firsthand experience in your own school or your kid's school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Now, Campbell, in your book, as I mentioned, you tackle a wide range of disciplinary practices and punishments in schools. And there's been concern, especially for students with disabilities, I think, of forms of isolation in schools, not just police referrals, but if students act out, as people might say, they're separated or isolated. How common is that?
There have been a lot of sort of muckraking reports on this very issue. It's often called restraint and seclusion practices, especially affecting students with disabilities. It's been nationwide over the last few decades, and it's only really coming to public attention now. And so I think districts are trying to limit its use, but it's not at all uncommon for students with disabilities to be, you know, locked in padded rooms or put in closets by themselves for long periods of time.
I've seen some advocates saying, you know, instead of some of these practices, we could be putting investments into social workers at schools, more of them, and counseling and things like that. Have you seen any trend, any effort to expand more of that in hopes of preventing the kinds of discipline we're talking about?
I mean, there are always, yes, there are training programs that you try to get social workers and counselors in. There's always some preventative aspect, which, of course, I would also support. I think part of the problem is that historically, police have been put into schools partly on that same rationale, which is to say they'll be a role model for the kids or they'll be able to sort of redirect the kids. And I think part of the problem, of course, is that the entire nature of having law enforcement in the school is to get the criminal justice system involved. And so as your prompting question to listeners would suggest, I think people will often say, well, police officers make the school safer. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that there's any evidence to actually show that that's true. Meanwhile, there's lots of evidence suggesting that having a police officer in the school will sweep up all sorts of kids, but especially students of color, poor students, and students with disabilities, and make them much more likely to be facing criminal charges for things as petty as disrespect or mouthing off or whatever, or for exhibiting signs, for instance, of autism. There are plenty of videos circulating of school resource officers handcuffing 7-year-olds who are clearly having emotional breakdowns or, you know, episodes. And again, it doesn't strike me as the most effective or humane way of helping children.
What do we know about outcomes down the road when that kid who maybe in one school or maybe in the past would have been treated with internal school discipline, now they're in the criminal justice system for something they did at school? How does that affect them down the road?
Right. So listeners might have heard the phrase the school to prison pipeline. And this is this notion that either directly because of facing criminal charges or indirectly just because it's disaffecting and they're less likely to continue going to school, children who have run-ins with law enforcement are far less likely to graduate, their grades drop. And interestingly, some studies have suggested it's not merely those kids, but that students at schools with a large police presence generally don't do as well. And so I think it can clearly send a message to students about trust, about respect, about safety. And it can lower morale and academic achievement as well as, you know, sort of the emotional outcomes that you would hope to see from schooling.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Crivitz. Kevin, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a story that related to this. My nephew, I think he was only about 10 to 12 at the time, but he's autistic and, you know, was acting up at school. And the teachers, you know, they just couldn't handle it. He wasn't being violent. He just didn't want to do what they wanted to do. They ended up bringing in the police, multiple police officers. They put him in a hold and gave him a bloody nose and put him to the ground. It was just, you know, outrageous how they would handle an autistic child who cannot be touched. And obviously, you know, it just was not a good situation for that whole thing. But of course, nobody, you know, they try to bring it to the school later, you know, my nephew's parent, and nobody did anything about it.
Kevin, I'm sorry to hear that story, but thank you so much for sharing that with us. I'm guessing Kevin's nephew is not alone in that experience, Campbell.
No, hardly. And again, whether it's someone with autism or not, I mean, kids often can be, you know, can mouth off or can be disrespectful. And I think when you have police officers who often lack specialized training, and again, just fundamentally are not educators, it's going to lead to a lot of these run-ins. And as Kevin's story suggested, they can often get very physical. And again, I think that raises a different set of questions about child safety.
But the teacher might not also have the training or the wherewithal dealing with all their other students at the same time. Are there other resources or training, or I don't know what we need at schools to safely and humanely deal with that situation?
Yeah, I think schools are starting to figure that out. There are trainings out there, and I think teachers are getting a better idea of this. And I certainly don't act as if teachers never do wrong either, or don't, you know, are somewhat responsible for marginalizing students. But I think that fundamentally, we need to be looking at both punishment and sort of the way the classrooms are run from an educational stance rather than a punitive stance. And I think far too often schools prioritize basic notions of order over child well-being or student welfare. And so really to try to keep teachers, you have to use punishment in ways that can really educate both the wrongdoer and the rest of the class, I think is fundamentally important. And this is something you've started to see a lot more with restorative practices in schools and more rehabilitative approaches to punishment.
Talking to Campbell Scribner, co-author of the book Spare the Rod, Punishment and the Moral Community of Schools. Let's go back to your calls now. John is with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a teacher, and, you know, I guess I'd start by saying I don't like how it's framed that this is a problem in schools. This is a problem with our society. You will see this in incarcerations, in jails. Who's put in jail more often? People of color, people with disabilities, people with mental issues. I think until our society it treats everyone fairly, gives everyone the same opportunities, we're going to have these problems. If you don't have a good paying job, if you can't put food on the table, if you have drug issues because of these things, these are the reasons kids are acting out. And I think it's more common in people with disabilities because they don't have the same advantages as the white people. I'm a white male. I had it pretty easy. You see laws that are designed years ago but are still in the books to support white members of our society. And until we figure this out, I don't know, you're going to keep seeing these problems. I think it's a reflection of our society, not just schools.
Interesting. John, thanks for the call. John's saying this is a problem that can't just be solved inside the school walls, Campbell.
I mean, I don't disagree with that, although I do think it's important to be clear on a few things. So, for instance, a lot of times people will point out that for certain violent offenses, there are not racial disparities in punishment, right? If a kid punches another kid, that kid's getting suspended no matter what race they are or what socioeconomic class. The fact is, though, that for lower level offenses, again, things like disrespect or insubordination, that's where you actually see profound distinctions racially, by gender, by ability, and other things. And so I think in those cases, yes, we need to be, of course, acknowledge that poverty is a problem and sort of diffuse notions of racism are a problem. But it's also the case that within schools, teachers are exhibiting bias, whether they recognize it or not. But as Angelica said earlier in your report, there is some level of racism, gender discrimination, class discrimination that's clearly at work here. And I think we need to be attentive to each one of those things and not just sort of say that it's society's fault or that schools are no worse than anywhere else.
In our last minute, can you share maybe a mindset change you hope schools can take on to change their approach to punishment?
Yeah, so again, I'm a historian, and if you look back to the 19th century, when, again, they're just whipping kids right and left, right? I mean, it was a brutal time for punishment. But the one thing that I approve of in the 19th century is that punishment was always aimed morally. There was a notion that you were trying to correct wrongdoing and put kids on the right path. And with the rise of the 20th century and to the present, a lot of teachers really ground their practice in what they would call classroom management, with this notion that it's not about morals. It's just, again, about sort of keeping order. And I think that fundamentally, punishment needs to be about addressing wrong and seeing it as wrong, but also to rehabilitate kids and to see kids as reformable. And so rather than merely keeping order, again, notions of restorative practices where there can be forgiveness, where there can be atonement, where kids can actually, you know, make it up to classmates, and they're not just suspended or arrested or expelled. I mean, I think fundamentally that needs to be the mindset change. The teachers are engaged in helping kids learn and grow rather than merely getting rid of them or punishing them.
Campbell, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Campbell Scribner is an assistant professor of education at the University of Maryland and co-author of the book Spare the Rod, Punishment and the Moral Community of Schools. I like using leftovers in my cooking. I always have. It's fun to see what you have in the fridge and figure out something new you can do with it. On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest takes it a step further and plans in advance. She cooks meals with a second recipe in mind right from the start, so we can get another completely different meal out of the parts of our cooking that take the most effort. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite kinds of leftovers? Do you like to eat them as is or make something new out of them? And do you ever cook meals thinking, this is meal A, but I'm coming in with a plan for meal B coming out of this stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Cassie Joy Garcia is the creator and editor-in-chief of the food and wellness blog Fed and Fit. She's a cookbook author, most recently of Cook Once, Dinner Fix, quick and exciting ways to transform tonight's dinner into tomorrow's feast. Cassie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I love this cookbook. All the recipes come in pairs. So one common ingredient you make goes into both of them. What started you down this road of kind of thinking ahead this way?
Necessity. I'm the mother of two small children, soon to be three in just a couple of months. And I work full time. And we just have a very richly scheduled household, if you will. And for some reason, getting dinner on the table night after night, even though I love to cook and I have been a recipe developer for over a decade now, was leaving me feeling exhausted and burnout. And I needed a more efficient system.
How do you go looking for pairs of recipes? We're going to check out some of these recipes in a bit, but where do you find, like, okay, if I do this work once, most of this cooking is going to transfer over to meal B?
You know, it really started with wanting to not only make life as easy as possible and roll that effort forward, like you said so well already, but wanting to keep some variety in what we were plating on the table night after night. Food boredom, especially through the pandemic, was something that we were really bumping up against, getting tired of the same dishes over and over again. And so wanting to mix in different varieties. And so what I found myself doing was, for example, cooking up a beautiful brisket for one night, serving it up with some pretty classic sides, maybe a slaw and maybe a polenta, for example, but then finding myself craving Mongolian beef, you know, a Chinese inspired dish, and using that brisket to help that come to life, but in a really quick way. And so it was more along the lines of what would be really exciting, what would be an exciting meal to have either the next day or the day after that.
I love this because I have done the thing like, okay, I'm going to make a lot of this food so we have lots of leftovers. And then day three, I'm pretty tired of those leftovers. All right, let's get into some concrete recipes. You've shared these with us. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Friday. Our first pairing centers around chicken, roasted chicken. So let's start with the first recipe in this pairing, roasted chicken and potatoes with fresh arugula salad. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Yes. So this is the... I'm a big believer in, I think we're making recipes a little too complicated. And so this recipe is such a great showcase of that because it's a roasted chicken that is so simply done, very, very simply done, but you're going to get maximum flavor and results. I wanted to make sure that this was a book that you could drop into the lap of somebody who was really a beginner in the kitchen, and they could confidently follow these steps and produce a really reliable, high quality result. So you're going to get this beautiful roasted chicken. And while the oven's on, I say, let's pop in some potatoes and roast up some potatoes along with that chicken. And then toss together a really nice, light, and simple arugula salad to go with it. If you're family or if you don't like arugula, spinach would be a really great one for one swap. And that would be meal one. And we would make that chicken with in mind, I'm going to make twice as much chicken than I know what we need tonight for dinner. And then those planned for leftovers. So if that means one bird for your head, that would be one chicken in my house. But I know in many homes, that would be two chickens or more. So the planned for leftovers already roasted, that gets put into the refrigerator for meal two.
And meal two, then we've got this chicken handy because we made extra. And we don't need to put any more time into making the chicken. Now we've got the key ingredient for butter chicken bowls with white rice.
Yes. And oh my goodness, are you in for a treat? That dinner is so delicious. So it's this Indian inspired dish, my version of buttered chicken. And it is a really delicious, creamy, tomatoey sauce with some really lovely, bold spices. But that comes together really quickly. And so what I like to do is take that leftover chicken, planned for leftover chicken, right? Chop it up, sear it in some either ghee or butter or olive oil, whatever you've got within reach. And then we just create the sauce really quickly in the same skillet and then serve this yummy curry style sauce over a fluffy white rice. And only the cook in the home is going to know that this was tied so closely with that roasted chicken dinner that you had already with the potatoes and the arugula. Nobody else who might be enjoying this fabulous meal is going to be really any the wiser.
You can find both those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Cassie Joy Garcia is our Food Friday guest this week. We're talking about her book, Cook Once, Dinner Fix, Quick and Exciting Ways to Transform Tonight's Dinner into Tomorrow's Feast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you cook meals with leftovers in mind, either with a plan to eat exactly that same meal again and again, or to know you're going to use the outcome of this dinner to make something completely different tomorrow? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Cassie, I do the grocery shopping for my household in addition to a lot of the cooking. This seems like a fun way. This would be fun to shop for, right? I know this is the centerpiece. This is the common trait of these two meals. And then I'm just like building both of them out of that. Is this kind of fun at the store?
I think it's fun. You know, if you're somebody who enjoys efficiencies, you're going to get a kick out of it.
Because,
yes, exactly. You know, if it's the way that I structured the book is it's not broken up. It's not really your typical recipe book. It's not broken up by appetizers, sides, and desserts, and so on. The book is broken up into five chapters that feature the main component. And so there's a poultry chapter, pork, beef, seafood, and vegetarian. And my hope is that when you go through the grocery store, let's say if you find your favorite ground beef is on sale, then you would know, oh gosh, I'm going to go find a dinner series that calls for ground beef, because a ground beef dinner series is going to have you brown up, crumble 3 pounds of ground beef at once, and then split it between two wonderful meals. And so it makes it really fun to shop and really shop efficiently.
Another thing I love about how you're talking about your meals and how you write about them in the book is the flexibility. Like earlier you mentioned, use ghee or butter or olive oil. You know, they might taste a little different. It's all going to come out fine. You give suggestions like that. Also, like, hey, you want this gluten-free? In some cases, here's how. You want this veggie? Do this instead of this. And I think that's a great attitude toward cooking. Why is that important to you?
You know, I want my recipes to be as approachable and inclusive as possible. And none of them are really precious to me. I'm a pretty terrible recipe follower myself. Yeah. And I find myself saying, oh, that sounds good, but I'm going to try it with this. You know, and I think there's a lot of fun and creativity that can come out of the kitchen when you approach it with that kind of anything's possible attitude. And it can just be a really fun activity, I think, if you just want to be a little bit more creative. And also, if that makes you nervous and you'd prefer to follow the recipe to the letter, I've got you covered.
let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Freedom. John, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your recipe combo, John?
I will start with a tongue taco, so I'll try to follow a traditional Mexican recipe. Herbs, garlic, bay leaves, spices, simmer that for 3 hours. After rinsing my scotch and whiskey bottles, a little bouillon. I then strain off that broth, and I will make beef barley soup, pot roast. Any leftover wine that we don't want will go in the pot roast. You can save broth anytime you want.
Awesome. I love it, John. I like the crossover. So the broth from cooking the meat part of his meal ends up being a soup. I kind of go the other way. I'll make extra of, say, the chicken or whatever, knowing that, you know, over the weekend, I'm going to put that into a big soup. What do you think? What do you think, Cassie?
I think that's brilliant. My goodness. That sounds great.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, John, at 800-642-1234. We heard from Darlene on Facebook, who said the whole reason for cooking is to have leftovers. I love it. How are you, Cassie, at sort of the scrounge, like I do a lot? You know, oh, I've got this in the fridge, I'm going to build a meal around that. You're thinking ahead, but I imagine you still do some improvising.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of improvising within bounds. You know, I found that if I really want to use up, I really love being able to use up all the vegetables. And I'm not going to say that I've got a perfect record or anywhere close to that, but some of our scrounge meals, if you will, is I will, if a recipe calls for half of an onion or, you know, 3 carrots or just not all the mushrooms that I have on hand, all of those extras of those vegetables go into what my veggie bowl in the refrigerator. It sits out right in the front. And then every week I do a red sauce for my girls. They love it with spaghetti. And I toss all those extra vegetables in there. And it becomes a really quick and easy way to scrounge for those leftover ingredients, the things that you've just got on hand. And it's a bit of a mystery, but you get to up the veggie content in that sauce.
That sounds awesome. We're talking to Cassie Joy Garcia on this week's edition of Food Friday, talking about cooking meals with a plan for leftovers. She's the author of the book Cook Once, Dinner Fix, quick and exciting ways to transform tonight's dinner into tomorrow's feast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like doing creative things with leftovers from last night's meal, or do you cook tonight's meal knowing you're going to use all or part of it in something similar or maybe something completely different? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, a cauliflower combo. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with professional home cook Cassie Joy Garcia. Her new cookbook is Cook Once, Dinner Fix, quick and exciting ways to transform tonight's dinner into tomorrow's feast. Lots of pairs of recipes, so you can use your labor twice. That roasted chicken goes into two completely different dishes, for example. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Cassie, before we go back to our callers, we got some chicken recipes earlier. You also shared some cauliflower recipes, starting with General Tso's cauliflower. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this is right out of the vegetarian chapter, and I love this dinner series. So we start off with, essentially, we want you to grab 3 to 4 heads, depending on how large they are, of cauliflower. Go ahead and cut off the florets, and we're going to roast them very simply with some olive oil, salt, and pepper. And then once they come out and they're nicely cooked, we're going to toss it around in a sticky, somewhat sweet, a little spicy General Tso's style sauce. And it creates this really delicious dish. And I serve that over fluffy white rice for meal number one.
And then meal number two, we got all this cauliflower lying around. Cauliflower tinga tacos.
Oh, gosh, that is a really tasty dish. And I'm so excited for folks to try it. So cauliflower tinga tacos, it is a Mexican style flavor profile. And it's a tomato-y sauce that has some chipotle in there. There's some good heat, some lime juice. And we create this really delicious rub, toss the cauliflower in that and re-crisp it. And so that really brings the cauliflower, even though it's already cooked and maybe you're on it's day three, right, of the cauliflower being cooked, brings it back to life and gives it new life, if you will, with this brand new sauce. Toast up some, I prefer some corn tortillas over a flame on the stove and get those nice and bristled or blistered, and then serve the tinga filling in there with some avocado and lime juice. It's delicious.
Sounds fantastic. You can find that recipe at WPR, both those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Green Bay. Susan, hi.
Hi. I just enjoy listening to this show, and I just wanted to make one comment. I am going to purchase this cookbook for my daughter. She's a 20-something, lives alone, not, you know, the most seasoned cook. But when you're cooking and for one person, there's often so many leftovers. And I think this is a great idea for a single person and what to do with the leftovers. Love the creative ideas. And I also love that there's a gluten-free and a vegetarian option as well. So I'm going to purchase this for my daughter for Christmas.
All right. Well, Merry Christmas to her. Susan, thanks for calling. Cassie, do you have thoughts on tailoring your combo recipes for cooking for one?
I do. Yes, actually. And I have actually a consideration in the front of that book. That's a question I get a lot in a lot of my recipe development projects is how do we scale this either for one or many, many more people. And so I have a bit of a compass in there for folks, but I say, you know, these recipes are written intentionally so that the math is going to be really easy, whether you're cutting it in half or doubling or tripling. So hopefully she feels very well supported with it.
Thanks a lot for the call, Susan. We're talking to Cassie Joy Garcia. Her new book is Cook Once, Dinner Fix, quick and exciting ways to transform tonight's dinner into tomorrow's feast. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us now in Wausau. Hey, Steve.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a avid believer of what we're talking about right now and do it all the time personally, but what I'm calling about is professionally. I've got 30 years of experience working with the nonprofit human sector, and for a while I drove a truck which would deliver food to a soup kitchen. And the cool thing was that there was one restaurant who gave us what we called what's in the refrigerator soup, and they would just put it together, and sometimes it had, you know, just all edible stuff, all good stuff, but it was their way of making a contribution to the soup kitchen. So this is my call out to restaurants and professionals to say, hey, how can you repurpose and encouraging, you know, upscaling and serving more people with leftovers. It's a great idea.
Oh, interesting, Steve. That is how I make soup at home, too. What's in the fridge soup. That's an interesting idea, Cassie. The pros at the restaurants can do something like this. In this case, they did for a soup kitchen.
I love it. That's brilliant.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Steve. You know, it's soup season here in Wisconsin, Cassie, or it's starting to be. I love making soup. What are some of your favorite ways to take leftovers out of the fridge or previous meals and soupify them?
Oh, my goodness. There are unlimited possibilities. I actually just made 3 big soups yesterday.
Wow.
And chicken, of course, is usually one that we're grabbing pretty often. But shredded chicken, I will make anytime I'm making shredded chicken, let's say for a casserole or something like that, I will usually double the amount of protein that I'm making and then store that shredded chicken in the refrigerator if I know I'm going to use it right away, or in the freezer. And then yesterday, for example, I pulled together this lemon turmeric ginger soup with chicken and sweet potato, and then tossed them some kale. And it was just really lovely and wonderful, but it came together so quickly. It was the most work involved was chopping up the sweet potato.
If you're making three soups at once, I'm going to go on a limb, Cassie, and guess that you're freezing some of those.
It's the postpartum baby prep.
No, but that's great. So what, and you actually talk a little bit about what can you freeze, what can you assume is going to change or not in the freezer. What are your thoughts for, again, for that convenient meal prep on the sorts of things that we can make with freezing in mind?
Yes. You know, there's a lot that I think that might actually be the beefiest part of that front part of the book is my freezer guide, because it is also definitely a frequently asked question. There's so much. If you've got the space available in your freezer, if you have a freezer and it's just not well organized, it might be a really great motivation to get in there and tidy it up a bit, because there's so much that you can do to organize your freezer, to set yourself up for success, to do future you some favors. And so I walk you through freezing either fresh components, so fresh ingredients, fresh vegetables, shopping while things are in season, and also freezing cooked components and how you might move through that. And then when it comes to reheating, which is a frequently asked question, what's the best way to reheat this dish or this kind of dish? What I usually like to tell folks is I think that the best place to reheat something is where you would have cooked it the first time. So if it's a casserole, for example, then you would I like to reheat it in the oven where I would have baked that casserole to begin with. Or if it was a soup or a chili, that would go on the stovetop in a pot.
Before we wrap up, Cassie, I remember when my twins were infants and I got really good at making things that you could prep during nap time. And then you could leave them in the oven or whatever when the kids got back up and they'd cook in time for dinner. Do you have any advice for fitting in that meal prep during a short nap time?
Oh, my goodness, do I. That's how I move through the day. So I say do the thing while you have the time to do it.
Yeah.
And even if it is as simple as pulling out your rice and leaving it in a measuring cup or in the pot on the stove without water, but the water measured next to it. So as you've got it out, because for me, I'm carrying around an 18-month-old on one hip with a big old baby belly. And it's just the possibility of doing more things with one hand or fewer in the hours to come. So do as much as you can, get as much out, your mise en place, if you will, during that nap time.
And Cassie, what's for dinners this weekend?
Oh gosh, dinner this weekend. We're gonna have carnitas. We're diving into the pork chapter. It's a most loved dinner series. We're gonna have those crispy, perfect carnitas cooked down a pork shoulder. And then meal two is the sticky honey garlic pork Asian style dish that my family just loves.
And when can I show up?
Anytime. You're welcome. Anytime.
Cassie, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
That's Cassie Joy Garcia, creator and editor-in-chief of the food and wellness blog Fed and Fit. She's also a cookbook author. Most recently, the book we've been talking about, Cook Once, Dinner Fix, quick and exciting ways to transform tonight's dinner into tomorrow's feast. We have a couple pairs of recipes up at WPR.org/Food Friday, one based on chicken, one based on cauliflower. Make them this weekend. Make them both and let us know how it all turned out.